Welcome to the History Podcast, guys. This is your host, Jason Thomason. Let's get started. Welcome to the podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the 27th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. We started talking about Woodrow Wilson last episode, but we focused more on his domestic policy. And today, we're going to focus more on Woodrow Wilson, the wartime president. And at the end of last episode, we talked about how Wilson tried very hard to stay out of the war initially. In fact, in 1916, he's going to campaign on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." He narrowly wins again in 1916, but things drastically change on the global landscape, and so it kind of forces his hand. We talked about the sinking of passenger ships that had Americans on board. Multiple times that took place where German U-boats or what we call submarines sunk passenger ships. And when Americans are killed, that gets the attention of the American president and the American public. And Wilson is feeling the need to do something. And the final straw that will break the camel's back will be the Zimmerman note, as we talked about last episode, the telegram that was written from Germany to Mexico seeking an alliance, promising to return territory lost by Mexico in the Mexican-American War if Germany was victorious. Once British intelligence intercepts this telegram, it is sent to Washington, D.C., and Wilson begins calling on Congress to make declarations and to determine whether or not to go to war, which he is strongly recommending. Once Congress votes for war, Wilson's got a tough job ahead because this is not a situation where the American public is fully on board with going to war. This is not World War II. This is not a situation where we were attacked on our homeland and now we're wanting to retaliate. In many respects, this is similar to Vietnam. Now, it's not as extreme, but it is in similar ways. You're going to see people resisting the war, resisting the draft specifically. And we're going to talk more about that today. But right out of the gate, Wilson is going to call on Congress to begin mobilizing for war. So Congress is going to pass the National Defense Act, which will help build the army. It'll build it by 65,000 plus. But that's still not enough. I mean, 65,000 men, as much as that may sound to some of us, it's still not enough to go fight on the scale in which we're about to go fight. So Congress, upon the approval of Woodrow Wilson, will pass the Selective Service Act. And this will require males 18 to 45 to register for the draft. And if their number is selected, which your number is not unique to you, they had these drawings, they even had, there's video footage of Wilson being blindfolded, and he reached into a hat and he pulled out a lottery ball, and that lottery ball determined, you know, who all would be going that night. And so if your number was selected, you were required to enlist and go fight overseas. Many Americans, and we're talking in the hundreds of thousands, resisted the draft. They refused to go, and they would flee to another country. They would flee to another city and live under an alias. Some were arrested for resisting. But nonetheless, this shows you that this is not a war that has the full support of the American people. So Wilson has to do as much as he can to garner more support for the war. One of the ways that he's going to do that is to create the Committee on Public Information, which he's going to put a former newspaper publisher, a guy that knows how to use words persuasively to convince people that this war is a just war for the United States to get involved in, and that is a man by the name of George Creel. And what George Creel will do is he will hire public speakers to go to different locations all throughout the United States to give 3 to 5 minute speeches where they will promote the war cause. They will get in and get out. And I've often been asked Why the short speeches? Well, they didn't want to leave any time for questions. They just wanted to get in, give you this big rah-rah rally speech, and then get out before too many questions were asked and they could get on. Wilson will also federalize much of industry to try to increase wartime productions, to make weapons of war, to make transportation for war, to make more clothing for war, to provide more food for the troops. All of these areas will be federalized during war, which will increase production, which will increase the economy. The economy will soar during war. And that's something that we learned from the Spanish-American War is, whether you believe in this moralistically or not, that's not the debate. What they understand is that war is good for the economy. And so during World War One, our entrance into World War One, war will benefit the economy. Going back to the Committee on Public Information for just a minute, they're also going to enlist the services of a man by the name of George Cohen. George Cohen's a famous musician, and they are going to have him write and produce a war song, a propaganda song is really what it is, where you're trying to convince the American people that this is what has to be done. This is the American way. We have to make sure that we do this. We're trying to help our allies. We've got to go over there and save our allies. It's for the good of the country and it's for the good of the world. And there's a song that George Cohen is going to write, and it's going to become the mantra of World War One, and it's called Over There. And for the sake of the listeners, I'm not going to play that song, nor will I sing it. But I can promise you, it is worth a listen, but be careful. It is a song that is very repetitive, and you will get that song stuck in your head. But that just shows you the effectiveness of the song. It worked in many respects. Despite the Committee on Public Information going all throughout the country and spreading the word about why we were entering the war, defending why it was a just cause to go over to Europe to fight in World War One, or the Great War as we called it back then, there were still many dissidents. People like Eugene Debs and the Wobblies spoke out increasingly about why we were going to war. They called this the rich man's war. This was the capitalist war, that this was only going to benefit the rich, that once we went off to war, as we already talked about, once we went to war, who benefited? And that's kind of what Eugene Debs was saying, was that this was a rich man's war fought by the poor man. And he was silenced because of two bills in particular that were passed as wartime measures, and that is the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. Both of these bills are going to try to silence those who don't support the war, making it illegal to speak out against the war, to speak out against the president, to speak out against the troops, to speak out against the government in any fashion during the war. Well, Eugene Debs continued to hold rallies to speak out against the war, and he was arrested promptly. And he will be sentenced to a 10-year sentence in jail. He will only serve 2 years, of that sentence. But the interesting thing about Eugene Debs is Eugene Debs, while in prison, will run for president of the United States and actually get votes, which is a very unique situation, a situation that we have never seen before, where you have a candidate running for president from his prison cell, which is just a fascinating scenario to me. But you can kind of see how the government is using what they feel are powers within their constitutional rights to restrict those who don't agree with the war. They're trying to use every avenue they have, including music, including advertising through magazines and posters throughout the country to promote the war. This is what we call propaganda. And you also see the fear of socialism. And that's what the Wobblies were. They were openly socialists. This is also during a time where the Bolsheviks have taken over Russia. And now that the Bolsheviks have taken over Russia, they are going to withdraw from the war. And when they raid the former Russian Tsar's government buildings, they start to uncover secret documents that were in the works between the Soviets, or the then at the time the Russians, and the British and the French. These secret treaties about how they were going to divide Europe after the war, these were not made known to the public, and that is kind of seen as sleazy and just not on the up and up. And Wilson knew about this, by the way. He was already aware of what was going on. But when we talk about Wilson's 14 points here in a little bit, he's actually going to address that issue. Because once the Bolsheviks uncover what is going on in Russia, they expose these documents to the public. And people across the globe are hearing about this, including people in our own country. And they're kind of wondering what's going on, because some of these dealings were a little bit shady. But nonetheless, Russia pulls out of the war. And now that Russia has pulled out of the Great War, Germany and the Austria-Hungarians are only having to fight on one front. And the belief is this is going to allow Germany to have some success if the United States does not get in quickly. Thankfully for the Allies, the United States is mobilizing as fast as possible. They're increasing their production, getting the doughboys ready to go fight overseas very quickly, and they will help bring an end to the war. But for the sake of this conversation today, we're going to focus more on Wilson's 14 points, which he will deliver to both houses of Congress on January 8th, 1919, where he's going to give some very lofty goals about what he hopes post-World War I Europe will look like. And I'm just going to kind of go through these very quickly. We'll talk about a few of them, and we'll kind of move on from there. But number one of his 14 points, an open covenant of peace. This was to address what was going on in Russia when the Bolsheviks and the communists took over in Russia, and they uncovered all these documents where secret treaties were being made on how they were going to divide up Europe between the British, the French, and the Russians. This was to address that open covenant of peace. Let's make things a little bit more transparent to the rest of the world so that there's no under the table dealings. Number two, freedom of the seas. Number three, free economic trade. Number four, a reduction of arms. Number five, sovereignty of nations and no colonization, which is almost kind of comical that the United States president is talking about no colonization because of what we had already done with Hawaii in 1898 by annexing them, even though they didn't want us to annex them. And also taking the Philippines after the Spanish-American War, and they certainly didn't want us to acquire them, even going to war with us for two to three years over that issue. Number six, the evacuation of all Russian territory. Number seven, restoration of Belgium. Belgium, poor old Belgium, is going to be just run through during both the Great War and World War II. I mean, every time that there's a conflict between the Germans and the French, the Belgians pay the price. And if you know your geography, they sit right between Germany and France. And so anytime that these two get entangled, it is poor Belgium that suffers probably the greatest loss in terms of their infrastructure. Obviously, loss of lives and things of that nature. But number seven dealt with the restoration and rebuilding Belgium after World War I. Number eight, Woodrow Wilson believed that all French territory should be freed and restored. The French lost a lot of lives in World War I. Them and the Germans came in a distant second to only the Russians, who lost millions. Or I shouldn't say millions, over a million troops during the Great War. Number nine, they wanted to clear, Wilson wanted to clearly define borders for Italy, whose empire had grown prior to that period. Number 10, Austria-Hungary would be assured independence. And when they break up Austria-Hungary, you're going to see a lot of the Eastern European nations that we know of today kind of form out of that. Number 11, Romania, Serbia, and Montenegro would be evacuated and freed. Number 12, the Turkish portion of the Ottoman Empire would be assured sovereignty. This is the end of the Ottoman Empire as we know it. And if you study world history at all, you know that the Ottomans have been a world power for a very long time. They have slowly been dwindling down until this point. And after the Great War, the Ottoman Empire will be no more. Number 13, this is a big moment. The nation of Poland will be granted their independence. They will become an independent state in Europe. And then lastly, this is Wilson's baby. This is the most important thing for Woodrow Wilson. He wants to create a League of Nations. He wants to create an environment globally that nations will come together and they will work together to prevent a catastrophic event like World War I from ever happening again. He believes that it is the role of nations like the United States and England and France to head up an organization like the League of Nations. The problem for Wilson is that he is going to have to get Congress to approve this. It doesn't matter what the rest of the nations believe. When he goes to the Paris Peace Conference, and we're going to talk about that in just a second, he can get all of them on board. But if he doesn't get the Senate on board, it doesn't matter. The United States will not be involved. But that's not going to be really a problem for him, because when he goes to the Paris Peace Conference, which, you know, he is going to be treated like a rock star when he arrives in Paris. I mean, people in Paris see him as the savior of the war. Like they believe that without Wilson entering the United States into the conflict, the Allies would have assuredly fallen to the Germans. And I mean, they are lining the streets, millions of people. They even dusted the streets with gold, as it was said, kind of reminiscing of what they used to do in ancient Rome, where they would throw, you know, gold dust on the ground when some hero would come through their streets. But, you know, as much of a rock star as he was treated like outside of the conference, once he entered the conference, it was a different world. And when Wilson delivers his 14 points at the Paris Peace Conference, it is not met with a warm welcoming. You know, the British are not real on board with the freedom of the seas. You know, they feel like the hammer needs to be dropped on Germany. They also, the French and the British, don't believe in point number 5 of Wilson's 14 points with sovereignty of nations and decolonizing Europe. They do, however, believe in the League of Nations, and they do support Wilson's idea for a league, because they don't want to get involved in another war like this, of this magnitude. But Wilson lost a lot of momentum when he delivered these 14 points, because there's a lot of them. And as I'm going through, this is why I read them as quickly as I could, because even as I'm reading these 14, you're probably thinking, man, this is a long list. The French prime minister, this, I've always found this quote just absolutely hilarious, and I wrote it down. I don't write a whole lot down for these podcasts, but I did write this down because I want to make sure I get it right. He was so bored with Wilson's 14 points that when he left, he was interviewed and he said, Mr. Wilson bores me with his 14 points. Why, God Almighty only has 10. This just shows you it was a laundry list. He needed to condense it. It was very lofty. It was very idealistic. And I think a lot of the power nations at the conference, i.e. Great Britain and France, they just didn't see this as realistic. And, you know, so they didn't approve but 3 of these when it came down to making the Treaty of Versailles. And the League of Nations was one of those that they approved, Poland being another one, and breaking up Austria-Hungary. But the Treaty of Versailles, which will be the treaty that will officially end World War I, will be signed on June 28th, 1919. As a part of the Treaty of Versailles, Germany will be forced to accept a war guilt clause, which basically puts the fault of the war on them. They will also be forced to pay reparations for the war. A little side note, and this is where guys like Eugene Debs kind of may have had something when they were talking about the rich man's war fought by the poor man. When war reparations are being forced upon Germany, American businessmen will issue loans to Germany. J.P. Morgan's family, J.P. Morgan dies in 1913, but his son, J.P. Morgan Jr., will actually loan money to Germany to help pay back the Allies, Great Britain and France, who owe the United States money. And so, American businessmen like Morgan Jr. want to make sure that the Allies pay the Americans back, so they're making sure that Germany has the money to pay back, and they'll obviously have interest on all those things. And this cycle of war reparations made by Germany to the Allies, or excuse me, to Great Britain and France, and then Great Britain and France to the United States, will continue until 1933 when Adolf Hitler takes over. Once he takes over, they will completely stop war reparations. A lot of that has to do with the global depression that's going on, but we may come back to that when we get to the Great Depression and World War II. But for now, we'll leave it at that. But also, as a part of the Treaty of Versailles, the League of Nations is formed. The embarrassing thing about this for Wilson is that the United States is not going to become a member. Now think about that for a second. That's like starting a club at school, promoting the club, putting advertisements up for the club, getting everybody to come to the first meeting, and then you don't show up. I mean, it's embarrassing to Wilson. The Senate will not vote for. They won't approve of the League of Nations. They won't approve of the Treaty of Versailles because they don't feel like the Treaty of Versailles is harsh enough on Germany. They also disapprove of the League of Nations simply because their argument is, and it's Republican dominated at this point in the Senate, that they don't want to get caught up in European entanglements again. And they fear, and there's some validity to this point, but they fear that if we join this League of Nations, that we'll be forced to help our allies in future entanglements. And we don't want to get caught up in that. They have seen the devastation of the Great War, and they don't want to get caught up in that in the future. Unfortunately, for those who have that mindset, the United States has moved up the scale as a world power. And if you think back to our previous episodes, we talked about the Spanish-American War in 1898. Because of our victory over the Spanish, we became a world power. But after World War I, we moved from a debtor nation, meaning we owed money to the British and to the French, slightly over $1 billion going into World War I. After World War I, Great Britain and France owed us somewhere between $4 to $6 billion. So we have moved up the scale in terms of being a world power. We are no longer a debtor nation. We are now a creditor nation, meaning other nations across the globe now look to us for help. And so you can't truly take this isolationist approach. Now, we're going to try. When we get into the 1920s and we talk about the presidencies of Harding and Coolidge and Hoover, we're going to take a very isolationist approach. But it's going to be very difficult to sustain that because of the power that we have become. The sad and embarrassing thing about the League of Nations is that once it is formed, it's not going to really have the ability to enforce the policies that came about because of the Treaty of Versailles, because the United States isn't there. Great Britain's trying to recover their in debt, France is trying to recover their in debt, and without the United States as a member, it's going to crumble because it can't enforce anything. I mean, it's without the United States of America in the League of Nations, the creator of the League of Nations, it does not have the political backbone, or the military backbone for that matter, to enforce the Treaty of Versailles. And so the poor enforcement of the Treaty of Versailles is really going to leave the door cracked. All it really does is make Germany more angry, more frustrated than it was before. And that was really what Wilson feared. Wilson feared that if we did not go into negotiations after the war with, I don't want to say, for a lack of a better term, forgiveness in mind, that we were going to open ourselves up and become more susceptible to future problems with Germany. And that's exactly what happens. And people can criticize Wilson for being too lofty, too idealistic about, what the world actually could look like, but he was right in a lot of regards. They walk away from the table furious, and they're going to pay those war reparations, and they're going to take the blame for the war, and they're going to reduce arms for a period of time. That is until the Nazis take over in 1933 and Adolf Hitler rises to power, and all of that's going to change. But we're not there yet. We're a few years away from that time period, and we'll talk about that as we get into our episodes on World War II. But let's get back to Wilson before I start chasing rabbits, because I have a tendency to do that. But Wilson is going to hit the campaign trail, and I kind of want to back up a little bit. But Wilson, while trying to get people to support the League of Nations before the Senate votes it down and all that, he's going to hit the campaign trail trying to get people to support it. And he begins to feel ill, not really sure what it is. They just think maybe it's fatigue. So he gets back to Washington, D.C. to go have his doctor take a look at him and get him checked out before he gets back on the road. But while he is in Washington, thankfully he got back when he did, because while he is in Washington, D.C., he has a major, major stroke, almost kills him. And it is such a devastating stroke that he never recovers physically. He won't make a public appearance again during his administration. And what kind of happens out of this is something that we really haven't seen before. And that is that his wife, Edith, is going to do a lot of work for the president. Like, she's going to deliver messages from Congress to the president and from the president to Congress. There are those historians who believe that she was kind of the president, the unofficial president, after Wilson has his stroke, that she did a lot of the grunt work for the president. I mean, he had a hard time communicating with her, and he did the best that he could, and she delivered whatever she could to Congress and vice versa for the remaining time that he was in office. And that was in 1919 when he had the stroke. 1920 is going to be a campaign season. Obviously, he's not going to run again. He could have by law. Again, there's no constitutional amendment yet preventing that. But he won in 1912, won again in 1916. He's not physically capable to run in 1920 anyways, but he will finish out his term in a very poor physical state. The country is out of the war, and the country, are looking to return to a sense of normalcy. And that's where we're going to pick up in the 1920s with the presidency of Warren G. Harding, who will campaign on a slogan of a return to normalcy. And we're going to talk about that in the next episode. But to finish up with Wilson, Wilson won't live very much longer after he leaves office. In fact, he's going to die in February of 1924. But I think it's important to understand that the administration of Woodrow Wilson was one where he addressed a lot of domestic policies that needed to be addressed and had been addressed in the two previous administrations of Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. And that momentum carried into his term, where he was able to get the passages of the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th amendments amended to the Constitution. He was able to get a lot of antitrust reform added to the Sherman Antitrust Act. But there are some things about Wilson's administration that don't get talked about a lot. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that he did very little to address the issue of race. And the same goes for the previous two administrations. Now, we can talk a long time about the issue of race, but you know, Woodrow Wilson will keep the forces segregated during World War I. And in fact, he is quoted as saying that segregation is healthy, and this is in a period where we're not far removed from a monumental Supreme Court case in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson. I mean, we're only a couple of decades removed from that, where that Supreme Court ruled that segregation was constitutional as long as it was equal. And as we all know, I mean, it was not equal. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. But the point is to show you that presidents like Wilson, Taft, and Roosevelt, as progressive-minded as they were, considering the people who came before them, they still were not willing to address the issue of race and inequality in our country. Just as Booker T. Washington tried to convince Roosevelt on many racial issues, including the Brownsboro affair, W.E.B. Du Bois, or Du Bois, depending on which part of the country you're from, tried to convince Woodrow Wilson to desegregate not only the military, but also to do something about segregation in society as a whole. And Wilson did not feel that it was his place to do so. And the reason I want to close with that is because we are heading into a period in the 1920s where racial tensions are going to rise. Not only racial tensions, but ethnic tensions. The Red Scare is going to come about in these next few episodes that we talk about because of the Bolshevik Revolution and the rise of communism in Russia. And there's a lot of domestic societal issues that are going to kind of come to a head in the 1920s. Even as economic prosperity rises, you're going to see social issues continue to be swept under the rug. And so I want to end it there with Wilson. And I hope that you've learned something. I hope that you've enjoyed learning a little bit about the wartime president and the domestic side of that president in the previous episode. In the coming episode, next episode, we're going to talk about the presidents of the 1920s, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. The 1920s, from a fashion standpoint, from a music standpoint, is a really cool decade. But from a racial standpoint, from an ethnic standpoint, there are a lot of issues to discuss, and I look forward to sharing those things with you in the next episode. Guys, I just want to ask you that if you don't mind, please subscribe to our podcast, and that way anytime a new episode is released, it will send a notification to you. We would also ask that you would give us some feedback, man. I don't care if it's negative feedback or positive feedback. We are looking for feedback so that we can help make this podcast more beneficial for everyone who listens. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. And as always, guys, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. See you next time.